Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, did you know that 20 years ago, Fresno named portions of three major streets after Cesar Chavez? Good luck finding them today because they no longer exist. It was an issue that divided the city back in late 1993 as the city council named and then promptly unnamed the streets. We'll talk with the man who helped organize that effort and ask if anything has changed in the last two decades. We'll also hear from the author of a new biography about Chavez, which hits bookstores today nationwide, who tells us the real Chavez was quite a bit more complex than the image we know today. We'll also learn why local ag educators are crying foul when it comes to Governor Brown's new budget and cuts to a grant that funds FFA programs up and down the valley. But first, our series called Voices of the Drought continues as FM 89's Ezra David Romero travels to the town of Mendota, as officials there are bracing for a tough summer and fall.
Twice a week, Robert Silva, the mayor of the rural westside town of Mendota, known as the cantaloupe capital of the world, meets longtime friends for coffee and pan dulce at a Mexican bakery half a block from City Hall.
Oh, no, this is good stuff. Very popular place.
It's called India Maria's.
Silva and I met over a buttery sweet dessert known as a concha to talk about drought.
9:45.
He says Mendota, with a population just over 11,000, is already feeling the impacts of drought in California.
This time of year, the work hasn't started. Latest figures we have right now, which is not good, we're 36% unemployment, and that's high. Normally it should be in the 29%.
Silva says the effects of drought are real to the town's citizens. He compares the current zero allocation of water to farmers on the west side to 2009.
When they did that cutoff, people just weren't ready, they were not alerted, and nor were there any surveys or any plans telling people this was going to happen. It was like a shock to a lot of people.
And shock is what the mayor and others in Mendota are fighting to deter in the current drought.
We're reaching out everywhere to educate people about water because, you know, it's complicated. It's complex, and a lot of people don't realize how the water systems work here in the valley.
In Mendota, the problem isn't drinking water, but jobs. The town has a reliable system of well water for residents, but the surrounding farmland is dependent on surface water from canals and reservoirs. Over 80% of those living in the town rely on agricultural-related jobs, whether they're farm workers, truck haulers, or farmers themselves.
It's a terrible situation that, you know, people didn't want handouts. They want to work, and the sad thing about it is that there's not going to be that much work available for them this year.
Silva is working with leaders across the region to prevent a total disaster in his part of Central California.
We have a lot of agencies in place for the next couple of months. They're gearing up for various things. We're still discussing issues. They're going to be better prepared, but it's sad that the breadbasket of the world here in the Central Valley has to start thinking about the food lines.
Dino Perez helps run the Westside Youth Center in downtown Mendota. Every day, about 20 kids come to the center to use the internet, play games, and for Zumba. The center also doubles as a food distribution spot.
Right now it's once a month, but we're in talks of trying to possibly expedite that and make it more frequent.
Last week, over 280 families lined up outside the center for bags of groceries.
They get a pack of spaghetti, a can of tomato sauce, a vegetarian soup, peanut butter, carrots.
That's Rosemary Gomez with the center. She's in charge of stretching the little funding the center has to make the greatest impact in the community.
A can of diced tomatoes, and they get rice, beans, and the can of mixed fruit.
Back at City Hall, the mayor is prepping for the worst.
People are realizing, hey, they need to conserve what they can. But there's a lot of fear out there that people have been working for years and years in certain jobs. Then all of a sudden they're realizing, hey, I might not have a job tomorrow.
He says the seasonal drop in employment that usually comes in the winter may hit the community much earlier this year. In Mendota, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You You can see photos from Mendota and our complete coverage of this historic drought online at our website, kvpr.org. And we'd also like to hear your drought-related story. How is the drought affecting your life, and what steps are you taking to save water? We've even created a special Tumblr blog to showcase photos documenting the drought's toll on the valley's people and places. You can share your photos and stories and find it all online at kvpr.org. California is instituting what some are calling the toughest regulations in the nation for the controversial oil extraction process called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. But some environmentalists say the regulations don't go far enough to protect air and water quality. Several local governments have enacted their own moratoriums. Others are calling for an outright ban on the practice. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, the politics are beginning to take center stage.
More than 1,000 protesters from around California came to the state capitol in mid-March with one goal: make politicians ban fracking. Latrice Carter is from the Los Angeles County city of Carson.
We are the citizens they are supposed to protect. Are you paying attention, Governor Brown?
Fracking protesters successfully grabbed Governor Jerry Brown's attention recently by interrupting his speech at the Democratic State Party convention.
Now, all you guys who like to make noise, just listen a moment. Californians, and most of you included, are driving over 330 billion miles a year. 330 billion miles a year, and 99% is fossil fuel.
Brown has angered some environmentalists for not imposing a moratorium on fracking, which injects sand, water, and chemicals underground to fracture rocks and release oil. But he has signed legislation that puts more regulations in place for the industry. Tupper Hull is with Western States Petroleum Association.
There is new monitoring requirements that are more extensive than we've ever seen before. There are water testing requirements, there are public notice requirements, there are absolute disclosure requirements.
Groundwater monitoring will be required before, during, and after fracking. Operators will notify neighbors within 1,500 feet of a wellhead 30 days prior to the start of fracking and will receive a copy of a permit that lists chemicals used and their volumes. Brian Nowicki with the Center for Biological Diversity says that may sound more comprehensive than it really is.
The proposed regs take the narrowest and most oil industry friendly approach possible as allowed under the law. And in so doing, they allow for this increase in fracking and the expansion of fracking across our state.
Nowicki says regulators are relying on other agencies to monitor air pollutants and water contamination. He says the regulations also don't restrict how much water is used in the process, nor do they deal with seismic risk.
The only way forward right now for the state to truly protect California's assets, our people, our climate, our air and water, is to halt fracking.
Jason Marshall, who oversees the state's oil division, says since January of this year, oil companies have submitted about 100 applications for well stimulation.
There haven't been a lot that have actually met the threshold for providing a groundwater monitoring plan where one is needed. I'd say there's probably somewhere in the vicinity of 30 well stim applications that have actually been approved since January.
Environmentalists say there are just too many unknowns about fracking and the risks it poses. Another bill to halt fracking is proposed this legislative session.
Tell me what democracy looks like.
Latrice Carter of Carson marches with other anti-fracking protesters around the Capitol. Until recently, Occidental Petroleum had plans to drill more than 200 new wells in Carson. But last week, the city approved a 45-day moratorium on all new oil and gas drilling. She says the best way to halt fracking may come from the local level.
Sometimes you can't run, you have to fight. And that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing.
Carson is the latest city to take a closer look at fracking. Santa Cruz passed a temporary moratorium last year, and the LA City Council recently voted unanimously to halt fracking in oil fields in the city. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You're listening to Valley Edition. charismatic, controversial, courageous, and complicated. Those are just a few of the words that could sum up the life of the late civil rights leader and farm labor activist Cesar Chavez. Now, over 20 years after his death, a new biography seeks to shed new light on his story and insight into a man who was an inspiration for millions. The book is called The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, and its author, Miriam Pavel, joins us now from NPR member station KCRW in Los Angeles. Miriam, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about how you came to write this story, because I don't think it's quite received this sort of treatment before.
That's true. This is the first actual biography of Chavez that's been written. The last authorized biography was done in 1975, which obviously was sort of in the middle of his own struggle and well before his death. I came to write the book precisely for that reason, because there was no biography that had been written about him, even though he's been dead for more than 20 years, and because there is an incredible, voluminous record that he left behind, both in terms of documents and hundreds of audio tapes that he made, precisely in order to preserve the history. And I felt that that was a history that should be told, and that he was a fascinating person. And I think that I wrote the book for people who have never heard of him, of which there are sadly an awful lot of people in the country today, but also for people who think they know who he was, because I think that I know from the close associates of his who have read the book so far that even people who knew him very well are learning a lot about him.
That's something I was talking with Diego Luna last week. We were talking about how many people know the name, but many more people don't know the story. Tell us about some of those things that maybe might surprise the people who think they know his story.
Well, I think that one thing is that sort of the story's been told in very sort of hagiographic terms. He's been kind of reduced almost to a very two-dimensional person and sort of sanctified in ways that I think don't do him any service, because his complexity is part of what makes him really interesting. So I think that some of the things about his early years and his education as an organizer and as an activist are really interesting, and a lot of that story has not been told. I mean, he didn't just spring full-blown as a leader of a farm worker union in 1965 when the strike began, even though that's the point in time at which he sort of, you know, tended to become part of people's consciousness, and certainly that's true in the Valley. And I think that a lot of the things about his methods and his philosophy and his beliefs and his work ethic, all of that are what kind of made him who he was. And he is a very complicated guy. He was brilliant and he was nurturing and he was ruthless at the same time, and he was pragmatic and he was dreamy, and he embodied an awful lot of contradictions. So that's the full picture that I tried to convey.
What was that like, going through those materials for you and becoming more acquainted with the man in a very intimate way in that sense?
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, it was really, it was an enormous amount of work, but extremely sort of exciting in some ways to see, you know, much of his material was handwritten. I mean, I feel sorry for the biographers of people today who are going to be, you know, looking at flash drives, because it's a whole lot more fun, I think, to be looking at handwritten diaries, you know. And then the tape recordings are really extraordinary. You know, from about 1969 through 1980, he just made hundreds of tape recordings. He taped all of the executive board meetings of the union from about 73 through 1980. And so you can be this fly on the wall and hear these just extraordinary debates over philosophy, over personnel. You hear him, you know, being sort of visionary and dreamy and imagining what 40 acres is going to be like, and talking about building walled-in oases and, you know, a farm workers' cathedral. You hear him cursing and having screaming matches with people, and then having these sort of very serious, agonizing philosophical debates about what the future of the union is. It's just... It was very time-consuming, but it was just absolutely remarkable.
I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on how Chavez fits into the quote-unquote great man or great woman school of history. If there hadn't been a Cesar Chavez, would this movement have arisen? Would someone else have filled his shoes, or was he the right person in the right moment?
I think so. I mean, I think it is a combination. He certainly was a product of his times, and the fact that he began to organize at the end of the Bracero movement, the guest worker program, was helpful. And even more so, you know, the it was the tail end of the civil rights movement. There were people coming out of the South. There was a tradition of civil rights activism that he played into in the late 1960s, you know, that helped him enormously in the early years, both in terms of staffing the strike and then the boycott. So I think that the times that he moved in were very key, and that he was the right person to do it. And as you said, I mean, his absolute determination to do this, you know, we haven't seen anyone else do it since.
You mentioned his complicated personality and the persona that we know today through the media and through his legacy as a civil rights icon. I think it's safe to say today. Tell me a little more about the complex nature of who he was as a man, as a father, as a leader. What was that inner tension like for him, the man?
He makes extremely clear that his work is what comes first and his family comes second. And there's no – he tells a story frequently, and he tells the story in slightly different ways in different times, so there's probably a degree to which it's apocryphal. But the story is about something that happened in 1955, so, you know, well before he comes onto the scene as a farm worker organizer. And the story is that he was working. I mean, when he worked for the CSO, he often, you know, took no days off and just had this incredible work ethic that he maintained for the rest of his life. And so the story is that he had been working so hard, and he decided that he was really going to take his Sunday off, and he was going to take his family on a picnic. And he told Helen that they were going to go on this picnic come hell or high water. And when Sunday morning came, someone showed up at the house, and sometimes it's someone who was arrested or whose, you know, father was arrested or someone who needed help. And he has to make the decision as to whether he's going to help this person or go on the picnic as he has promised his family. And in some versions, he goes on the picnic and he just feels miserable the whole time and ruins it for everyone. And in some versions, he just cancels and helps the person. But the end is always the same. And the end is that he says to his wife, you know, I have to make a decision whether I'm going to be of service to people or I'm going to be a servant. And once he makes that decision, and he makes a decision to be a servant, then he is not conflicted anymore. Then his work comes first. And that drives the rest of his decisions. So, you know, there's just example after example in his early years back in the 1950s of dropping his wife off at the hospital when she was going into labor and going off with Fred Ross to investigate a problem in King City, and, you know, not being there for his son's graduation and so forth. So, you know, he was just a very intense, driven person. And he talks about that, and he talks about that on the tapes. And he says, you know, I don't have friends, because if you have friends, you have personal relationships that affect your decisions, and I'm just single-minded, and this is what I do. So, you know, that is part of who he was and what enabled him to do what he did. On the other hand, there are people who would look at that and say that there were a lot of things he did that were very ruthless.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Miriam Powell. She is the author of a new biography of Cesar Chavez. It's called The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, and it is in bookstores nationwide starting today. His greatest strength and his greatest weakness, what do you think that those two would be?
You know, his greatest accomplishment, I think, was giving people who had thought themselves to be completely powerless and were exploited and disenfranchised, giving them a sense of their own power and their ability to affect their change. And he did that for farm workers. And he also, by extension, did that by example for whole categories of people and poor people. And in doing that, also taught a whole generation of activists how to organize. And, you know, si se puede. And he really imbued people with that spirit that it could be done and that change could happen. And he showed by example that it could. So his ability to do that, his strategic brilliance at figuring out tactics, at figuring out how to make the boycott work, which was, you know, not that simple, all of that was to bring farm workers into the national consciousness in a way that they had never been. Those were his greatest accomplishments. That's not your question, was his greatest strengths. I mean, his greatest strength was his strategic brilliance and his commitment to achieving those goals. I think, you know, there are a lot of charismatic leaders who are able to build something and then struggle to run it. And he's certainly not the first one to be in that position. And that was his difficulty. He could not relinquish control to delegate to the extent that he needed to do to make the UFW be a functioning labor union. And ultimately, he left a tremendous legacy in many places in terms of the people that he trained and who learned from him and as a role model and as a hero and a heroic figure for generations to come in the cities and across the country. But he did not leave a legacy for farm workers in the fields in the end because the union failed.
We're now in the second decade of the 21st century. Many of those who marched alongside Cesar Chavez are still with us, but increasingly we're losing that generation. What was it like talking with those individuals who were intimately acquainted with Cesar and recounting their stories so many years later?
You know, that's really in some ways what got me into the story and into his story was through the people who worked with him and for him and were part of the union. Because I've never met anyone who worked for the UFW for even a short amount of time who doesn't say that it was the most important thing in their lives and that it changed the course of what they did for the rest of their life. So I was sort of fascinated by the force and the power of a movement. I mean, I have not seen or experienced a social movement that had that kind of impact on people. So the people who were drawn to it were, you know, just a really interesting, eclectic group. It was partly, I mean, his ability to bring together and to draw on labor and religious groups and students and other kinds of activists and to sort of knit all of that together into the movement that was part of his great appeal and accomplishment. So it was fascinating to talk to people. I mean, for most people, those memories are still a really huge deal. And by the same token, for many of them, many people who were committed to trying to build a functioning bread-and-butter labor union for farm workers, they were still really in some ways almost haunted 30 years later by questions about what went wrong and why the union ultimately failed and whether they could have done something different. And did Chavez go off on the path that he went because of, you know, events that could have been different? So their disillusionment in some degree and the hurt and the anger, and many people were thrown out of the union who had worked for it and had not talked about that and for years, and sort of, so the emotions of people and talking about who worked with the UFW and talking about those years are still, I think, really very raw in many ways.
Do you think that there's more attention to his story and his legacy now? We have the holiday in California. Your book comes out today. The film by Diego Luna comes out later this week. Is that a correct assumption? Do Californians really know his story, though?
Honestly, I think no. I think people know just a very superficial story, and I think that's in some ways deliberate. There has been a real effort to sort of simplify his story. There are, you know, there were children's books about Cesar Chavez, but this is the first actual biography of him for adults. And again, it's not for lack of material, since there's been so much available for so long, and he went to such lengths to save it all. But I think to some degree it's a coincidence in terms of the interest now. I mean, the holiday's been true in California for many years. The movie is the family's story, and, you know, it's their movie. And I know they, you know, searched for a long time to find the person that they thought that they wanted to work with and who they thought would tell the story the way they wanted it told. So to some degree, it's completely a coincidence. I mean, I started this 3 years ago, so it's a coincidence that these two things are happening at the same time. That said, I think that the demographics in the country and the increasing presence of Mexican-Americans and Mexicans and the immigration debate that's going on and President Obama's efforts to sort of highlight Chavez for, you know, whatever his own reasons in naming the, you know, a ship after the USS Cesar Chavez, and then in making the UFW headquarters and where the compound in the Tehachapi Mountains where Chavez lived and where he's buried, making that a national monument, all of that has kind of generated some degree of interest and some aware, you know, a greater degree of awareness of him. But again, most people really don't. And when you get outside of California in the Southwest, people have no idea who he was.
We've been talking with Miriam Powell. She is the author of a new biography of the late labor leader and founder of the UFW. The book is called The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, and it's available in bookstores nationwide starting today. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and continue our talk about Cesar Chavez, but with a totally different angle. 20 years ago, the city of Fresno named three major streets after the late farm labor leader, but you can't find them today. They don't exist on any map because almost as soon as they were named, they were wiped right off the map by the same city council that voted to honor him. We'll talk with the man who led the effort and find out what's happened in the past 20 years. Has anything changed? And is the movement to name the streets still alive? That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. 20 years ago, shortly after the death of Cesar Chavez, a group of Fresno residents led a successful push for the city council to rename California, Ventura Street, and Kings Canyon Avenues in memory of the UFW leader. The decision was controversial, and less than 2 months later, the council reversed course and removed Chavez's name from the map, restoring the original street names. It was an issue that divided Fresno. And while many cities have gone on to name streets and schools and other facilities for the late farm labor leader, the events of late 1993 are still controversial to this day. Joining us now for a look back at that time is one of the people who led the effort to name the street in honor of Chavez, Venancio Gauna, who was the chairman of the Cesar Chavez Committee and was with the group El Concilio de Fresno. Mr. Gauna, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore, for this invitation.
Let's walk back in time now and go back to 1993. Your group organized to honor him in a way that many cities have done since. How did it come about originally?
We were very stunned by his death, and many of us, of course, came from the fields ourselves. And we had worked with the United Farm Workers of America and Cesar. We had marched with him. We had boycotted grapes. We had boycotted lettuce. So we were very familiar with his efforts. And so we were stunned, and we wanted to do something to honor his legacy, his memory. We had begun to hear that other communities were going to do things in his honor. We felt that here was Fresno that had supported the movement of the United Farm Workers many, many times. And we wanted to do something not only for him, but especially for farm workers and the Chavez family.
Did you realize what a controversial move that would be at the time?
Oh, yes. We knew from the outset that we would have opposition, and that's why we organized Mr. Moore, and we had countless meetings. Of course, Chavez died April 23rd. We started in mid-May. First, we had to get the permission from the family of what we were going to do. We were able to obtain that. But we wanted to organize and have input from the community and reach out to other constituencies that were non-Chicano Latino, or for the lack of a better word, non-Hispanic. So we did that. We tried to make appointments with every city councilman at the time to express our intent, our plan, and to seek their support. We reached out wherever we could. We had a committee of 53 people in the beginning, and to this day, there are still some people that we're still meeting along those lines in terms of what to do next.
So initially, you formed this committee and went to the city council, and in October of 1993, the council said, yes, we will rename these streets in honor of Cesar Chavez. What was that initial vote like? I imagine that had to be a great feeling of success for you at the time.
Yes, it was a feeling of success. But we became very much aware. Remember that that we were planning to do this in August, and we were concerned with the questions that had been raised prior to the vote on October 12th about signage, about payment for the signage to the city, also the concern of businessmen. And so we knew that not all was well, even though we received the support of 4-3 on the city council. What really concerned personally many of us was the immediate effort by then-Mayor Jim Patterson to ask for reconsideration of the vote. The vote had just passed, and he asked for reconsideration, as I recall. So we knew that we had taken step one. But to hold that vote, because it became apparent that there were forces at work that were going to continue to ask for reconsideration, that if they could get someone of the four, one of the four, to ask for reconsideration, that might change everything.
How did you go about selecting the streets, Ventura and Kings Canyon?
Well, there were really three, Mr. Moore. There were really three: California, Ventura, and Kings Canyon. The reason for that was, one has to remember that although we do not get the recognition, there has been many people of Mexican descent and other Latinos that have come into Fresno and made, in particular, West Fresno, spreading into Southeast Fresno, their homes. They worked in the fields. They were picked up by trucks in the 40s and 50s to go out in the fields in Chinatown. So to those who do not remember, California has been a home to many people of Mexican descent, in particular Ventura. Now the people kept, shall we say, moving in an easterly direction, and even today there are many thousands of people of Mexican descent in Ventura and into what is now Kings Canyon. So that was one of the reasons. The other reason was that Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers had boycotted or had led marches in Ventura Street because there used to be a Safeway store at the height of the Great Boycott. I forget the name of the particular street. I want to say it's west of 7th Street. I know that much. So that is where we wanted to tie all of that together: population, the cultural heritage, the movement. And we didn't want to have pieces that we would only start, for example, from C to G. We wanted the entire length of those streets that belonged or were part of the city. And we were somewhat, shall we say, thinking ahead that we wanted to tie in with the African-American community because Martin Luther King Boulevard goes up to California Avenue. But that didn't work out in the minds of some folks.
Yeah, and those three streets all essentially connect as they go through downtown Fresno from West Fresno to downtown Fresno to Southeast.
Yes, from west to east, or east to west, if you like.
Yes. Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we are talking with Venancio Gauna, who was the chairman of the Cesar Chavez Committee in Fresno and was with the group El Concilio de Fresno 20 years ago, led the effort to name some significant Fresno streets in honor of the late farm labor leader, an effort that was successful only to be overturned by the city council 2 months later in December of 1993. What happened with that second vote?
Well, the street was actually named for 41 days, Cesar Chavez Boulevard. It was named, as you said, October 12th. But there was another city council meeting on October 28th where the mayor again asked for reconsideration. It didn't pass. But then on November 30th, that's the evening where there was a major City Hall meeting at the Saroyan Theater. That's where the vote was overturned. That's where the mayor used his position to overrule or not allow the people, because there were over 1,500 people at that meeting. He did not allow some, shall we say, speakers at the time. Many speakers were overruled.
And the street that was named for 41 days then reverted to its original name.
Right.
What was that feeling like with your group at the time?
Well, I think that there was a lot of dismay. There were people that cried. But we also looked at it as that we were not going to give up, that Cesar Chavez and the Union had instilled in the people, instilled in us, that we were not to be defeated. And that is why after that evening, we continued to meet and seek other ways to, shall we say, restore that name. Unfortunately, we were not successful.
Shortly after this, the Fresno Adult School was named in honor of Cesar Chavez.
Yes, but that was another little maneuver that was done, shall we say, by the opposition, because they were able to muster the support of the Board of Fresno Unified School, that the new school, we wanted to name what is now Sunnyside High School in honor of Cesar Chavez. But what they did, which we had no control over, they brought up the topic of naming the adult school first, and that passed unanimously. That adult school is truly a little jewel that exemplifies what he stood for, especially in education.
Since these days, 20 years ago, many things have changed. States from Idaho to Illinois to Oregon, Texas, Wisconsin, Nevada, and of course California have named major streets, major parks, community centers in honor of Chavez's name and his memory. Looking back at it now, do you see Fresno was ahead of its time? Do you think it would be more controversial if this effort came about today rather than 20 years ago?
Well, I think that things have improved in the, shall we say, to be blunt about it, some people that were against Cesar, just like he died, they have also died. But unfortunately, people make jokes about, you know, that Fresno is a butt of jokes on certain programs. Well, this is another manifestation of how parochial Fresno is at times. I think that there have been some improvements, and we're working to see if we can continue to strive for the naming of those streets. As I said before, this is not something that has gone away. We're continuously working on it in many aspects and in many ways.
I want to read a quote from the Fresno Bee back in 1993 about the naming situation, and this is from Eli Setensich at the time, and he said, "I think this is old Fresno, reluctant to change. They see all these new people coming in, and they don't want to share the pie. We're still a redneck city. We're not Mississippi, but we're not too far removed." Has that changed, or maybe
I
not
think
changed?
I think that Mr. Setensich hit the nail on the head. It's changed. The question is, to what degree? You know, I would honestly say that if we were to go back to city council tomorrow or at the next meeting and ask for this, there would still be opposition. It would not pass. But then again, one of the things that we are doing is working very hard to bring about voter education of community people, not just Latinos, but all. And we're doing it through the democratic process, and we hope that eventually that will change.
Again, we've been talking with Venancio Gaona. He was the chairman of the Cesar Chavez Committee in 1993 and was with the group El Concilio de Fresno. He helped lead the effort 20 years ago to rename Ventura, California, and Kings Canyon Avenues in memory of the late UFW leader. For 41 days, those streets were named Cesar Chavez Boulevard, but the city council later reversed its earlier decision, and in December of 1993, the original names were restored. Venancio, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to reminisce and bring back information that many people today are not aware of.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Here's a question for you. Do you deserve to be happy? In this segment of our commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State philosophy professor Dr. Andrew Fiala discusses the pursuit of happiness and the question of what we ought to do to be worthy of happiness.
Scientists have developed a variety of ways to measure happiness, including measures of positive attitude, social networks, physical health, and so on. Using these measures, the World Happiness Report recently concluded that citizens of Northern European countries are the happiest. A related Gallup poll found that Midwestern American states are happier than Southern states. I wonder, however, whether people in Nebraska or the Netherlands deserve to be happier than those in West Virginia or Syria. Our culture views the pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right. If that's true, then Syrians deserve to be as happy as North Dakotans. But does each person really deserve to be happy? Criminals don't deserve happiness. Or do they? And those who deserve to be happy, saints and heroes, often fail to find happiness. The fact that morality does not guarantee happiness can leave us feeling, well, unhappy about morality. It's not fair that good people suffer while evil people thrive. This problem often seems to require a theological solution. Reward and punishment in the afterlife are thought to equalize the imbalance between goodness and happiness. But without appealing to the afterlife, we can argue that morality makes happiness more likely. Moral habits provide social, emotional, and intellectual stability. Morality helps us avoid guilt. And those who are virtuous can safely say they deserve the happiness they enjoy. The link between morality and happiness is as old as Aristotle, who told us 2,500 years ago that virtuous activity was the key to well-being. However, unlike today's scientists who study happiness, Aristotle also asked whether we deserve to be happy. To pursue happiness without morality is to put the psychological cart before the moral horse. A single-minded pursuit of happiness will often fail to achieve its goal. The direct pursuit of happiness often leads to moral collapse in egoism and narrowly focused hedonism. Ethics is not about making ourselves happy. It's about making ourselves worthy of happiness. Happiness should properly result from virtuous activities done for their own sake. We don't love our neighbors so that we can be happy. That's not love. But when we love others for their own sake, we find happiness. Some view morality and happiness as absolutely opposed, as if good people have to stoically do their duty without any joy. But virtue does not demand misery. It's okay to enjoy loving your neighbor or to be proud of your virtues. Nonetheless, the focus of morality cannot simply be self-satisfaction. There are some things we ought to do, even though they do not result in our own happiness. Happiness may follow morality, but the reward is usually only found when it's not directly intended. So, while we are busily pursuing happiness, we ought to consider whether we are worthy of the happiness we seek. We also should develop compassion for those who remain unhappy, despite the fact that they've done nothing to deserve their misfortune. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Go to a rural high school in Central California, and one of the most popular extracurricular programs will be FFA, Future Farmers of America. But now the people who run those programs say their future is threatened in Governor Brown's new budget. It's all part of a big change to the way school districts get their money from Sacramento, the local control funding formula. In general, it's been good news for schools up and down the valley as it redirects more money to districts with high populations of low-income families, English learners, and foster youth. One of the ways it does that is by erasing dozens of different state-specified funding categories, putting the choice of how to spend those funds in the hands of local districts. But one of those categorical programs that would go away is a $4 million matching grant for ag education programs that supporters say is essential for their future. Last week, FFA students and leaders gathered in Sacramento to protest the proposed change at the annual Ag Day at the state capitol. Joining us now on the phone to talk more about this issue, we have Ralph Mendez. He's the Ag Coordinator for the Kern High School District in Bakersfield. And in studio, we're joined by Kevin Woodard, an Ag instructor at Clovis East High School in Clovis. Kevin, I want to start with you. What was the response last week like from students and your colleagues in ag education programs? Like, I understand you had a big rally at the state capitol.
We did, all based around Ag Day 2014, and we were fortunate to bring some students up and from my government, ag government and econ class, and show them around the capitol, and they could get a little bit better idea of a lot of the stuff and kind of make it real, the things, the topics that we were discussing in class. We were able to come together with what was reported as hundreds, but I believe it was thousands of young members of the FFA, and to voice our support for AB 2033 and continuing the Ag Incentive Grant process.
Now I want to turn to Ralph from Kern County. What exactly is the concern here? The governor is changing the way schools throughout the state get their funding, and he says he's giving local districts more control. Why the concern from FFA groups?
That's a great question. It's a difficult position for us to be in, because on the one hand, many of us applaud local control of the money that the state collects and having that money sent back and distributed by boards in the different school districts across the state. In this particular situation with the Ag Incentive Grant, there are some things that make our program much different than the average categorical money. Categorical money is what Governor Brown's trying to eliminate. And if you think about the 80-some-odd categories of categorical money that get sent back for local control now, ours is the most unique in that ours is an incentivizing body of money. So the money gets sent, and it incentivizes the district to do things above and beyond the call of duty. And that money has to be matched by the local school district. So if a dollar is sent from Sacramento to the Kern High School District where I am, my district has to match it with a dollar. And thirdly, our programs are tied to distinct standards. And if you don't provide the money for the standards, our programs eventually will fall apart, much like wood shop and auto shop and home economics and many of the other programs that we've seen go down the tubes in the last 25 years, all the way back to Proposition 13 when school funding was changed the last time. So we're very concerned about the funding not flowing to the district for standard reasons, for the incentive grant incentivization, and for the matching part of it.
Kevin, when it comes to your district, Clovis Unified, and your program at Clovis East, give us an idea of what we're talking about. Statewide, it's $4.1 million, but what does it mean for your program? How much money do you receive, and then what does that allow you to do?
Yeah, the allotment that we receive each year that we apply for and then receive it varies from year to year. It is one of the components is based on student enrollment. One of the factors that's a little unique to our program is that student enrollment is calculated based on 9th through 12th grades. We have a large 7th and 8th grade program as well, so we see over 1,000 students a year through our program. So because of our larger class sizes and a few of the standards that we've not been able to meet, that was part of the standardized requirement that we have for the incentive grant, we receive about $24,000 to $28,000 a year. And then that's, of course, a grant that is going to be matched by the district.
Turning again to Ralph in Kern County at the Kern High School District,
yeah.
What about your situation on the ground?
Our district's like a small region within itself. We have 12 high schools that have agriculture programs that serve 3,200 ag students in the southern San Joaquin region. We get anywhere from $175,000 to $200,000 for those schools. And again, our district matches it, and the community helps match it as well. The impact for us is that my district will probably continue to have ag programs because we think ag is important here to the Valley, and especially to our students and students that are looking for jobs or looking to go to college and major in agriculture. So I'm sure we'll still have ag programs. What we're most concerned about is the districts up and down the state that maybe don't have the capacity to continue to fund their ag programs. And most certainly, Kevin will back me up here in that our ag programs don't just pertain to what we do in the classroom. If you can envision the three circles of ag education, we have the classroom, but then we also have the hands-on experience, which is outside, partially outside the classroom, and then the FFA participation, which is also outside the classroom. And these funds help our students travel to competitions and go to workshops and conferences and participate in fairs. And without that money, like I say, my district will still probably have the classes, but we'll be less able to do the other things that we do that enrich our program and make this model of ag education one of the best models that's ever been invented for education.
Kevin, when it comes to the benefits of the programs that you provide, when I always talk to FFA students, I find them very well-spoken. I know that's a big focus for the students who are involved in FFA and developing their public speaking skills and talking about the story of agriculture. What do you think are some of the things that people don't think about the benefits of FFA? It's not just about, oh, they're in 4-H and they're learning how to raise a young animal.
Right. There's that stereotype. And even when I was in high school, I was not involved in the FFA programs when I was in high school. And, the stigma was it's cows, plows, and sows. And it's so much more than that today. Of our classes, over 75% of the courses that we teach in our program meet some requirement, whether it's UC, A to G, entrance requirements, graduation requirements. So it's not your traditional what students, what parents and communities might think of as an ag program. The public speaking is a tremendous part of it. And it doesn't matter. I do coach the livestock evaluation team. And so people think, okay, well, I saw that on Napoleon Dynamite where they're judging cows and it is something fun, but it's also that public speaking portion of it where they now have to defend the decisions that they made earlier in the day. And public speaking, and Ralph could probably back me up on this, is probably a core soft skill that we have across the curriculum in all three circles that obviously is something that's going to help us and help our students later in life.
I think it's also probably going to be one of the things that's hit the most. That ability to take the kid to a parliamentary procedure contest or to a job interview contest or to a prepared or extemporaneous public speaking contest is going to be diminished if we can't travel with these kids and go to places like Fresno State and Cal Poly and UC Davis. We're afraid that this money won't get put back into the governor's budget just because it's an idealistic view that the governor has to eliminate all categoricals. I think that we're working on it. We've got some stuff in the works in Sacramento. We've got Assembly Bill 2033, which is being prepared to try to encourage the governor to put it back into the budget. It's got a lot of signatures and a lot of support. My thing that I want to finish with is that school districts do one of three things with their money. They either prepare kids for tests, because they have to make sure those test scores pass, or they prepare kids for graduation because the graduation requirements come up, or they prepare kids for things that they receive money for. And if you take Ag Incentive Grant away from a school district's money and you spread it out over all of the schools in California rather than the 312 schools that now currently get the Ag Incentive Grant, and ag is not a graduation requirement, and ag is not found – the things we teach kids in ag are not found in any of the state testing data. It's really hard to test what we teach kids. Then I think probably not next year, maybe not the year after, but certainly in a 10-year period, 75,000 students that we now affect in California will dwindle down to the low 30s, and we'll see programs close up. It'll be the demise of the FFA program as we know it.
We certainly wish your programs the best. Again, we've been talking today with Ralph Mendez on the phone from the Kern High School District. He's the ag coordinator for those programs in Kern County. And also joining us in our studio today, Kevin Woodard. He's an ag instructor at Clovis East High School in the Clovis Unified School District. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, that's all for this Valley Edition. Remember, you can send us your comments via email, talk@kvpr.org. Or you can tweet us. Just go to @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.